Hello and welcome to Last Born in the Wilderness. I really want to first, before we begin, before I introduce the guest of this episode, I want to just thank my patrons. Thank you so much for your continual support. This is a completely listener-supported podcast. To those that are contributing through the Patreon, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. And of course, to everyone else, for those that are subscribing, that are listening, that are sending me your feedback, for those that are donating with one-time donations, for all the other ways in which people support this work, reviewing on Apple Podcasts, for example. I just really want to thank you all for your continued support. But for those that are listening, and if you'd like to contribute and become a patron, I would ask that you do that by going to the website, patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. You can contribute a dollar or more a month there. You can do that in monthly or yearly contributions. And by doing that, you'll get early access to these interviews before the public release. There's other exclusive content. And also, you'll gain access to the Discord server where we have some very lively, very fun, very engaging, very supportive conversations with one another. I've really enjoyed the people that have contributed to that server and has made it what it is today. And so, to introduce our guest for this episode, I speak with anarchist writer and activist Peter Gelderloos. He returns to the podcast to discuss ecological revolution from below, which has been beautifully documented in his most recent book, The Solutions Are Already Here, Strategies for Ecological Revolution from Below, published this year by Pluto Press. Nothing short of revolution is required to address the global ecological crisis. The technocratic solutions that have been presented to us by various capitalist nation-states and nonprofits are less than sufficient in mitigating the most dire consequences of biospheric collapse and runaway climate change. In fact, more than just merely insufficient, these top-down so-called solutions actively reimpose the dominant socioeconomic and political order that is producing the crisis to begin with. As Gelderloos describes and points to in The Solutions Are Already Here, numerous land-based movements around the world are rising to the occasion, actively protecting territories from extractive capitalist enterprises, reclaiming what has been taken and exploited for industry, and building resilient autonomous communities and networks, many of which that span the artificially imposed rural-urban divide. To really grasp the scale and scope of this ecological revolution from below, Gelderloos lets representatives of these movements speak for themselves, weaving them into a tapestry that enlivens a radical imagination of what a post-capitalist world may hold. Well, Peter, thanks for coming on the podcast again. You were on some years ago, and I've been really looking forward to this discussion. I've been reading your most recent book. It was published a few months ago. The Solutions Are Already Here. And I was just really taken taken aback by how just the kind of scope of it. I think it was kind of the book that I've been looking for to talk about all the various and seemingly disparate but and also somewhat connected movements around the world that are addressing the ecological crisis. And one of the things that I deeply appreciated as well is you don't really look away from the realities of it. There isn't this sort of hope attached to it as much as just a realistic look at what's really going on and how communities around the world are organizing around the realities of climate disruption and the ecological crisis and all its forms. So I just appreciate the honesty that you infused into every aspect of the book. So I just want to thank you for putting it together and for agreeing to come on the podcast again.
Thanks for saying that. That's really good feedback, and thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah. I think and that's really the first thing I wanted to talk about is the scope of the book. The real feeling that I got was just the magnitude of the moment that we're living in. Mm-hmm. Where it's obvious that we are, like, just to give you an example, like this morning, kind of felt darkly appropriate, I suppose. But I'm up here in the Pacific Northwest. I woke up to the smell of smoke Because the windows are open because it's nice. It's cool outside. We woke up and there's just this smell of smoke. It's very hazy here right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a reality that we're kind of waking up to every year, every month is just more climate catastrophes and ecological crisis. But the feeling is that people are very much aware of that around the world. and they feel it very much in their localities where they're living. So I really wanted to just have you speak to how you approached discussing this subject, the ways in which you provide a macro view of the crisis, but then you really hone in and you allow so many people around the world to speak about the movements that they're part of, the communities that they're in, and how they're choosing to engage with the crisis. I just want to get your thoughts on just how you approach just the scale of this crisis in this book.
I think we need a break out of like seeing scale on like a single continuum, like on like the zoom bar of like, you know, a camera on your smartphone, or like the zoom bar of like, you know, Google Maps or whatever, that it's just like a larger or smaller scale. I think there's like qualitatively different ways of relating with scale. And so what we're used to, how we're trained to think, what like the visions that, you know, that are granted to us by like the very same institutions that are completely tied up with the ongoing destruction of life on this planet, are either you focus on the small scale, which means like, you know, just the individual, and always, you know, consumer choices, because if an individual is being centered, it's always an individual with like a certain amount of privilege and normative power in, you know, global white supremacist capitalism. So it means someone who can think about like, what kind of car do I want to buy? What kind of, you know, cell phone plan do I want to buy? Which is obviously a very ridiculous and limiting scale to focus on, and a very disempowering way to conceive of action, and a way that's not going to give us any kind of real consciousness about what's happening to the planet, even in the bioregion that we live in. Or we're granted like, you know, this large scale, like the macro scale, and the visual metaphor that often will come to mind thinking about that is like the NASA view of spaceship Earth. So like the photograph of Earth, which is a beautiful photograph, but the photograph of Earth taken from space, like, you know, this big, you know, floating blue and green and white ball, which has no detail, has no particularity. And neither of those scales are helpful. Neither of those visions are helpful. So it's obviously a global problem that that needs to have global consciousness. So a lot of the scholars and NGOs and whatnot that focus either on degrowth, which is a perspective that has a lot to offer, but focus on it from that, you know, that framework of degrowth, or who focus on alternative energies, they're thinking about the global scale, but in a way that has to tune out all of these relevant details. So like if one person or one institution tries to focus on the planet as a whole, they're going to have to silence most of the inputs and focus on just a few criteria like carbon dioxide parts per million in the atmosphere, which is just deeply insufficient. And so that's like all of the resolution that gets lost when we just kind of, you know, slide the scale bar up to get like the global view, which is a very false global view. Like no one is looking at the planet from that, you know, that like NASA spaceship view, like seeing it from the outside. So it's obviously a global problem that needs a global focus, but it's also, it should be obvious, an intensely, intensely personal and local problem. Like what you mentioned, you know, you wake up in the morning and you smell the smoke of forest burning. And that's an experience that you could share with people in a number of other territories or bioregions across the planet. For example, in one foot in the States, one foot in Catalonia. In Catalonia, where I've been living for the last 15 years, we're also experiencing desertification and catastrophic wildfires. Like that's also a reality, but happening in a very different way with like, you know, different particularities. And in other places, what they're facing is coastal flooding as like the big problem. So it's an intensely particular problem, and it's intensely personal, because we need to be connecting with what we're losing and how our lives are being destroyed. And if we don't do that, if we're just, you know, imagining the problem from like the safety and security of like some orbiting spacecraft taking taking, you know, beautiful photographs of Earth, and like that's our idea of what global means, then we're not going to get this problem. We're not going to get what it actually means. We're not going to get how it's actually unfolding, and we're certainly not going to have like the urgency and the connection to be able to do what we need to do. So I think we really need to break scale out of like this mold of either like the alienated individual, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, my own backyard, or like the detached technocratic. I know the idea of the technocratic gaze is something you wanted to get into later, yeah. but like mm-hmm. that kind of ultimately simplistic yet sophisticated technocratic approach that like doesn't really get what a planetary issue means, because it's can so easily, you know, pull itself away and pull itself out of that.
Yeah. And it seems as well that the people, because I mean, I think everybody is feeling the pressure, feeling the urgency of it, but how that urgency and that sense of action is being enacted, how that's being channeled into, activism or whatever it may be, it's going to be very different for many different people. I think, yeah, we feel it on the local level, like, what do we need to do here? But I think often the solutions that are presented to us come from sort of a corporate lens, a technocratic lens. Mm-hmm. It comes from, you know, nonprofit NGOs, comes from states. It's like, mm-hmm. we need to keep this machine going. Let's try to do that in a way that it feels better, that we feel more like, oh, I'm spending my money better in a more ethical fashion. That's often how it's being, ultimately what it seems to come down to. What I appreciated about the movements you were documenting in the book is that many of them were aware of the shit. They were aware of how much of that was just bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. And that was sort of defanging the movements in addressing the core issue, which is about capitalism, which is about extraction, and the all the incentives and all the kind of things that come with a system like this. So, I mean, I appreciated the diversity of the people that you were speaking to in these movements, in these communities. If you could, I don't know if there's anybody in those movements in particular that really stood out to you, that you could speak to, just sort of to give us a taste of the diversity of voices that you were highlighting in the book, things that really like kind of capture the moment that we're in and the ways in which, you know, trying to upend a system can really come, that kind of activism, that kind of direct confrontation comes in different forms. And I really think that speaks to the uniqueness of each locality and how they're dealing with this crisis.
Yeah. maybe I'll actually start by speaking about some folks who are very much in the book, but are completely invisible if you just read the book. Mm-hmm. Because, if you want to get, I see it as like stories and experiences, but if you want to get information, you know, from all over the planet, like there has to be a huge infrastructure in place to just be able to get that information. And in a book, it often can come off as like neutral or just something that's, you know, there existing objectively. Mm-hmm. But I never would have been able to like do interviews with those folks and like share those stories and experiences in the book if there hadn't been like a great infrastructure in place, similar to, but hopefully in a very, very different way, how like an academic writing about like, you know, like the need to implement a shift towards renewable energies on a planetary scale to, you know, reduce the carbon dioxide PPM the mm-hmm. adequate amount before 2030 or whatever, also is relying on like a vast global infrastructure to have access to the information that they're presenting, but they're typically presenting very different information. And the infrastructure that they use to be able to gather that information is usually like riding on the back of an ongoing and centuries-long process of colonialism. One of the aspects of which has been to like, you know, feed this scientific machine and like, you know, turn lived realities into like dead, dried and desiccated data that can be plugged into the machine. So I want to highlight a little bit of that. So these are not interviews that appear in the book, but they'll maybe give an indication of some of the interviews that appear in the book. I'm gonna keep them anonymous because they they didn't give me permission to like, you know, get names, shout outs on a podcast. But I want to name, for example, some like really amazing and like brave and intelligent comrades from Indonesia who were able to get the resources together to travel to, you know, several countries around the world, in Europe, in the case when, you know, where I was able to meet them and like, you know, create some of the contacts that made it possible later to find the contact of a Dayak anarchist. Dayak is an indigenous group from Borneo, which is under the control of the Indonesian state, to talk about resistance against the palm oil plantations, with palm oil being like a really, really interesting product because it's, you know, coming from a plantation economy. So definitely related to colonialism first, like, you know, the direct colonialism by the Dutch, the British and others in Indonesia, and then shifting to neo-colonialism with like an Indonesian government, like, you know, taking that over, but maintaining the same plantation model. And it's also interesting because it's, palm oil is like, you know, one of the vegetable oils that can be used in as like, you know, like a substitute for like animal fat. So it can be like, you know, used in like, you know, like, for example, like vegan diets that are presented as ethical. More importantly, and I think on like a much more significant scale, it can be used as like an alternative energy source. So like the way that there's like this shift a lot of times with like, you know, these ultimately corporate or NGO voices like George Monbiot, who like have like the global take, but this like superficial global take where you're like silencing most of the information, silencing most of the inputs, you know, they're talking about the need for like, you know, for like us. And so that's also very coded who us constitutes, to shift to more efficient diets. And really what that's doing is that's making room for a shift to like vegetable energy sources. So like not like a really big change in the global economy, like being based on like some kind of extractive fuel or another, but just shifting from carbon fuels to, among others, vegetable fuels, which like in terms of a carbon cycle, that's sustainable. But in terms of colonialism, like that's continuing, you know, the exact same cycles that have been in place for centuries and that are really at the root of the destruction of the planet. And I never would have like, to have like an interview where someone can talk about their struggle and they can talk about the dangers they face and they can talk about, you know, like their hopes and dreams and their aspirations, like a certain amount of trust needs to be in place. And for that to exist, there needs to be care, there needs to be contact. And that, but you know, I never would have been able to get get a contact like that on my own. And so it was like thanks to, you know, comrades who aren't in the book, who like realized that like solidarity means relationships, solidarity means international networks, and they like, you know, put together like scarce resources to be able to go and travel to other countries and like meet comrades. That's like huge. And so without what they did, then, you know, like I wouldn't have been able to get an interview with the Dayak anarchist in in the book, talking about like the neo-colonial model of palm plantations and like the genocidal indigenous model of palm plantations, which is huge since palm plantations, you know, they can be a part of ecocidal capitalism and they can also be portrayed as a solution to global warming. And so I think that's really important because a lot of times anarchists in the global north, we have more resources to travel, but a lot of times we treat travel as just sort of like radical tourism. Like, you know, oh, let's go to this other cool place and like, you know, take some photos, learn a few things, but we go as individuals and like individuals don't exist. Like it's just like a major, major part of like one of the victories of capitalism, convincing us that this kind of Western vision of the individual is like a real thing. Like we need to be traveling like with a realistic sense of responsibility, like making relationships, sharing relationships, and then building things off of those relationships. another example, I'll try to be much less long-winded since somehow I managed to, I don't know, talk like half
an hour about that. No, you're fine. You're good.
a friend from Brazil who's a translator who participates in, like, you know, collective with other folks who translate. Translation is often a thankless task. It's a lot of work. It's really, really beautiful work. It can be beautiful work. It's also tedious. And it's like the people who translate because they've read something in a language that maybe a lot of their friends don't speak and they want to be able to share that. Like that's like, you know, really beautiful work and sometimes underappreciated work. And translators are more likely to have international contacts because, like, you know, they speak different languages and whatnot. So this one friend in Brazil who translates, you know, between English and Portuguese, fortunately I already had contact with him. And I knew, like, I, you know, from, like, you know, reading articles and, like, you know, being just, like, aware of the news and whatnot, I knew there were really amazing and powerful struggles going on, like anarchist struggles, lower class struggles, and indigenous struggles. And not, these are not three separate categories, these are all overlapping categories happening in the Brazilian in Brazil, in the state of Brazil. And but, like, you know, you can't write, like, a quality book, like, when if all your information or most of your information is coming from news articles, because, like, with a lot of love for, like, the few exceptions who are, like, you know, really, really quality writers and researchers, most journalists are hacks. And sure. Most journalists, like, really that's, you know, that's not, you know, like, an individual failing. That's because, like, the news as, like, an artifact is, like, structured in a way that it's going to be really, really hard to get by as a journalist without being superficial. Without responding to, like, a fast-paced news cycle, very, very super, like, not questioning the idea of framing, like, you know, getting both sides of an argument. Like, what argument has two sides? Like the fact that, like, anyone could, like, say the phrase both sides of an argument with a straight face just, like, illustrates that, like, people haven't had time to do the work that they need to do if they were, like, to take their profession seriously or if they were to take their craft seriously. So, like, it would be, like, shameless to, like, write a book about, you know, global ecological struggles if I were just, like, basing it on news articles, because, like, that's not, it's enough of an indication, like, okay, maybe something interesting is, like, really happening there, but, like, it's not a basis for, like, talking about what's happening there. So I was able to get interviews with folks in Teia dos Povos, like, a really interesting network. I got, like, another like, a couple different experiences that bring together indigenous people whose lands are occupied by the state of Brazil and lower class folks in Brazil, like, often, like, you know, in the cities or, like, leaving the cities in order to, like, there are, you know, a number of projects that focus on food sovereignty, and that's really interesting. Food is a total tangent, but food is a really, really interesting question, because in the mainstream discourse, they won't admit it, but if you follow the threads in the mainstream discourse about the climate crisis, as they limit it, food and climate are in competition a little bit, because food takes up room that could be, you know, devoted to other things. We need to, like, you know, reduce that room. So food and climate are kind of in competition. Food is seen as, like, a food production as, like, a producer of greenhouse gases. And many of, like, the most radical, most intelligent, and, like, most deeply rooted, both in, like, a history of struggle against colonialism and in, like, a territory and a specific bioregion, many of those most, like, beautiful, intelligent struggles tend to find a perfect synthesis between the struggle for food sovereignty or food autonomy and for restoring the ecosystem and helping humans, like, you know, once again, like, be a healthy part of their ecosystems. And there's a lot of really inspiring examples of that in Brazil. And I was able to talk with some of those folks, thanks to these comrades and friends who do translation, who have those contacts and who can put us in touch. So those folks don't appear directly in the book, but the book would have been impossible without those forms of care and relationship building. And hopefully that will give listeners a little bit of a sense of the extension. Like, there's folks who, you know, participated in the ZAD in France. There's indigenous anarchists from Indonesia. There's anarchists and indigenous folks in Brazil and Venezuela. There's urban gardens in the U.S. There's, like, I really wanted to find people to talk from, like, very, very different experiences and situations from all across the planet.
Yeah, there is a real sense when you describe that. There is a real sense of these. There's, like, an infrastructure or something, or, like, there's, like, a series of relationships and connections that are tying all these things together. It's not just you writing about it. It's obvious that you have made connections through these relationships that have been built over years to find out what's going on in this region with these peoples over here. Things that you may not have otherwise known about, because it seems like a lot of the things that are documented in the book are not mentioned in the so-called mainstream press or in, you know, journalism as you described it, right? So much of it is left out. So that was what was really startling. That's not the right word. Surprising. There's a word I'm trying to think of here to describe the feeling of coming across like, oh, here's another land-based struggle. Here's another one. It's like, that's what I mean when I talk about the scale and the scope of the book, is that you're providing a view that is rare in discussing the ecological global crisis and what's happening all over the world and pretty much every continent. And speaking to those connections, this sort of ties into, I think we can talk about food sovereignty in here as well. But, you know, in reading it, there's personal, there's points in the book where you're very personal about your own kind of, like, I think it was in maybe the first chapter earlier on, you're talking about the scale of the global crisis, and then you're talking about where you live, and, you know, becoming more attuned to the life that lives there, that is embodied in the land, that is part of the ecosystems. And this sort of feeling that I get from you is that in pursuing this subject through this book, and I'm sure just in everyday life, that in many ways you're describing something that's common in the work I do and discussing, it's been described as animism, or this sort of view of all things contain consciousness and life. Like, there's a genuine respect and reciprocal relationship with all living beings, even things that don't fit under the definition of being alive, under the kind of Cartesian or Western reductionist view. So you look at a river, a lake, a forest, that is a living being, and is deserving of existing in a reciprocal relationship. And so when we think of like food sovereignty, as you describe it, people are recognizing, and have already recognized, many of these people are like, we've known this forever, that human beings are ecological beings. We don't exist in we're not separate from the land. We're not separate from these living systems. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is trying to further integrate ourselves into these systems that, due to the legacy of colonialism, neoliberal capitalism, and so on, has attempted to create separations and barriers between us and that living system, and has impoverished both the living systems and us, if we were to think of us as separate beings, separate categories. So I would like to talk about how food sovereignty fits into this act of resistance, because I think when we think of resistance, you know, there are obviously direct confrontations with state forces like the police or militaries, or there's direct confrontation with, you know, industries that are trying to extract minerals and resources, so-called resources, and, you know, fossil fuels out of the ground. There's direct confrontation with those entities. But there's things like learning how to grow a garden and how to regenerate the soil, right? That is as much, if not more, a part of it than anything else. So I would like to ask about food sovereignty and how that fits into this kind of these resistance movements. Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, I'll just say that I prefer the term food autonomy.
Food autonomy.
But I'll go back and forth between the two. Okay. Because food sovereignty is more widely used, and most of the things that are referred to or that refer to themselves as like projects seeking food sovereignty are super valid. They're great. It's just a more easily co-optable term because it's more easy to take it as like a property of the nation state, and to be integrated into progressive politics that that are very limiting or damaging in other ways. So I think food autonomy is interesting because it spells out that the people, growing and eating the food, need to have the control of defining how that happens and what that looks like. Whereas like sovereignty is historically a word related to like the rights of a state, which is you know, problematic and reflective of the ways that progressives usually don't think much about like history and words, mm-hmm. but also like, I'm not going to like split hairs. The vast majority of projects that are mm-hmm. like described as food sovereignty are like great, wonderful projects. And so we just do need mm-hmm. to be aware of like politicians trying to, limit how far we're going with that.
Right.
So, food sovereignty is really, really powerful as a practice, or food autonomy, because it reminds us that we are living things. And so you pointed out I think you pointed out both sides of this, but like, it's easy to focus on the sort of anthropocentrism or human supremacy, which is ultimately and historically white supremacist, because like, you know, what gets defined as human and like what are the mm-hmm. characteristics of being human are, you know, like that definition is under the control of these, you know, historically colonialist white supremacist institutions. And whenever you have like, an in-group and an excluded other, there's always going to be like a great act of violence against the people, against the beings who are like at the margins and who are like, you know, kind of in the borderland between like the mm-hmm. the self and other. So that's really dangerous. And it's really important to look at the ways that I don't know what to call it, like, you know, Western society or like, you know, this kind of, you know, colonial dominant capitalist society has really, really like demeaned and damaged other life forms, other you know, just like other forms of life, other, you know, animals, plants, and all that, but also the way that they impoverish us by like trying to take us out of nature, which is of course an impossible project, but mm-hmm. it's one that, you know, they cause a lot of damage in attempting. So by focusing on food, we're reminding ourselves that, you know, oh, that's right, like we need to eat, like we're living beings, and we only exist, we only live through our relationship with other living beings. And like eating and being eaten, that's like a very important relationship. Growing, fertilizing, cultivating, these are all super important relationships. And so on, like to start on, I mean, you know, what we could just like directly call like a spiritual level. I know like a lot of, especially white people aren't comfortable with that, but like, yeah. You know, I think that's like a kind of silly discomfort. Yeah. We it's really, really important to remind ourselves that our survival is on the line at a much, much deeper level of like, you know, oh, will we die in the future because of climate change? But our survival is on the line because like we have been tricked into forgetting that we are living beings and that we live through and with other living beings. So that's really, really vital. Second, we can totally dynamite the division between like, you know, productive or constructive or creative struggles and destructive ones, because in order to grow food or in order to have like food, not all food is grown, but like in order to feed ourselves, we need to be able to have access to the land. Mm-hmm. And the land is subjected to capitalist regimes of property. So that's mm-hmm. illegal to do that. So we actually, like, we will directly put ourselves in conflict with a central movement of this cacophonous capitalist symphony, which is like just like wrecking the planet, when we try to feed ourselves outside of a capitalist market and against a capitalist market. And a lot of the most powerful struggles around the world come from when people, as a matter of survival, insist on planting gardens in, you know, taking over abandoned lots and then defending those, or yeah. in, you know, not leaving the forest that they've grown up in, but staying there and fighting back against both the environmentalist NGOs that want to turn the forest into like a nature preserve, and, you know, the logging companies and, you know, or, you know, tourism companies that, you know, want to bring disenchanted, yeah. you know, people from the global north on their, like their, you know, jungle holiday or something like that. So like mm-hmm. I think that we really need to do away with like that dichotomy between like attacking the system and like, you know, healing ourselves, building things up. We definitely need to like pay a lot more attention to like activities of like healing and care and the relationships behind it all, because I think we're very much like trained to devalue that as both yeah. part of like, you know, patriarchal socialization, and also because of the way that capitalism trains us to see the world as like a collection of objects rather than as like the relationships between mm-hmm. all these different living things. So there's, I'm sorry if I'm like, you know, being more abstract, but I think like the way that we even begin to conceive of the notion of food has to change. At least, you know, when I say that, like, you know, we, you know, people should, you know, self-identify or not, like, freely, depending on like, you know, the circumstances that they were brought in and up in and the things that they were taught. But I think that these are like misconceptions around food and survival that are going to be pretty common, at the very least, like among white people, and probably like a lot of other people also like brought up in the global north, or like post-colonized people who are like no longer part of an indigenous community that is like still surviving outside of and against colonialism.
Right. Yeah, it just seems like when it does come, you know, a lot of it comes back to food, and it just seems like this, obviously food is so integral to survival. So our relationship with food, how it's produced, I don't know how else to say it. It's just incredibly central. And it seems like once you begin to engage directly with that subject and with that reality, the material reality of what food is, then it connects you to the land itself, all of its complexity. It connects you to community. It also, once you really begin to engage with it seriously, it seems, based in what I'm reading in your book and in this discussion, is that it forces people to directly confront a system that does not want them to have any sort of, we can say, sovereignty or autonomy over their own ability to feed themselves.
Yes, that is a much more concise way to put it. You should delete my answer and put in your summary.
I listen, and then I'm like, okay, how do I concisely like make a bite? Yeah. Anyway, no, everything you said was beautiful. I just want to make sure that is, you know, reiterated in a way that like I understand. I'm speaking to myself more than anything. Mm-hmm.
If I can get more concrete for a moment, sure. And less long-winded, two experiences of gardening in countries that I've lived in. Back when I lived in Virginia, little apartment complex, I started like, you know, just expropriating some of like the lawn in front of the apartment complex to start a garden. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, both tragically and like a bit of good fortune, like, you know, one of the wage workers, you know, paid to like occasionally go by and do like lawn maintenance or whatever. Like, it was just like days before I was about to harvest potatoes. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I really wouldn't eat anything from here, because once a year we got to come through here and like we you know, throw down a bag of stuff that says like, you know, toxic, like, yeah, you know, not fit for mm-hmm. human consumption. and so that's like an interesting way of oh crap, English. What's done the commons historically? Breaking up in Catalan, it's like cerca.
Oh, enclosures?
Yeah, enclosure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no worries.
It's like a chemical enclosure. It's like, that's a way of like enclosing a commons that like, you know, they didn't even have to like, you know, send any like cops around or build any like hedgerows or anything like that. You know, they just put these horrible chemicals on it. Mm. And so in large parts of the US, there's like a very interesting fight against lawns and the culture of lawns. Mm-hmm. And I think a very, very interesting, like, if you want to get like nerdy and strategic and like, you know, do like, you know, deep dives in like brainstorming, and an interesting question for like anarchists and other like, you know, actual anti-capitalists, is how do we make the war against lawns not just feed into middle class homeowner activism of like, you know, folks with a mortgage who have read Michael Pollan and are like, you know, oh, this is really interesting, and they're maybe sincere, but they just have no idea, and they have enough structural privileges that they will never need to have any idea. So like, how do we like get into like reclaiming the commons of, because American cities are mostly built with a lot of cheap petroleum in mind. Mm-hmm. That's usually really bad because it means things are car dependent. It also means that American cities are much less dense. So most cities in the US, with huge, huge transformations to like how space is used, and, you know, a whole lot of asphalt being ripped up and a whole lot of like bioremediation with fungi and whatnot, could come closer to like food self-sufficiency, like, you know, within the limits of their territory. That's something that needs to be, there's, you know, a lot of exceptions that need to be added there and whatnot, needs to be talked about in more detail. But like, like the struggle against, you know, lawns and whatnot, like could be like really, really interesting, but like not if it's just like, you know, homeowners, like, you know, having like food gardens instead of something else. Another experience in Catalonia, when I moved out of Barcelona, really a lot of interesting urban gardens projects in Barcelona and like vacant lots. But where I was living when I was like an hour outside of Barcelona, like kind of more like a small town, we were expropriating farmland right outside of our apartment complex. And it was land that had been farmed to death, land that was like at the end of its productive cycle within like the capitalist mode of like throw a bunch of chemicals on it, ride over it with a big industrial tractor a few times a year. And in a bioregion that's facing severe desertification, like it's going to become like a desert in like the wasteland sense, if like over the next few decades, people don't do like a lot of things to like help, you know, help the ecosystem shift into something that can deal with less rainfall in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And so we were dealing with a really, really impoverished, compacted soil that was just, it had just been farmed to death by capitalist farming practices, which are like, so in case anyone has missed the memo, industrial agriculture has failed. It is already a failed system. And so we are in like a very, very brief grace period when we need to figure out other ways of feeding ourselves, because industrial agriculture has already failed. And so we were like doing things, you know, like different gardening methods and whatnot, and also like a lot of interspersing, you know, trees, like, you know, fruit trees and nut trees and stuff like that with gardens. There is a shepherd not too far away that like we were like, you know, inviting him to come. And that was great when like the sheep and the goats could come through, because they were, if, you know, if pastoralism is done well and there's not too much market pressure and like too high a density, but like they can go through like the right rhythm, like, you know, a couple times a year with lots of time in between for the fields to grow back. Pastoralism, like flocks, goats and sheep, they're like great for in not every bioregion, but in many bioregions, for the fertility of the soil and the diversity of, you know, the flora, until like, you know, there's like some, you know, dickhead homeowner like nearby who like would complain about like, you know, the goats and the sheep sometimes like going like, you know, from the field that we have next to the apartment complex going over to his yard, and that fucker is like out there every Sunday with like a fucking weed whacker. Like, what? Like, you just like, do you hate yourself? Like, do you just dislike life so much that, I don't know what's wrong with
people. It's okay. I think many people relate to this feeling that you're expressing, right? You're like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you like this?
you have sheep and goats that are cute that will come by and like do that for free without making noise, and you don't have to be like in the sun on a Sunday with like a weed whacker. Yep. I just don't get it. But so yeah, so like very, very different experiences of gardening. And so like that's again why like the sort of like simplistic macro global scale vision won't work, because like what we have to do is so particular and it has to be adapted to where we're living.
Right. Yeah, there's kind of ties into this question I wanted to ask about the rural urban divide. And much of that is imposed. It's an artificial divide. But nonetheless, many people experience is that life in a city is very different from life in a rural area, whatever that is for you, right? I've lived in rural areas most of my life, coming from what is called Idaho, right? Southern Idaho. It's a high desert. It's largely, most of the land is either public lands owned by the BLM, like managed by BLM, or it's agriculture and dairies, right? Or, you know, living in a city has its own, I mean, it's traffic congestion, it's polluted, it's awful for all these other reasons. But nonetheless, you know, what I was really taken by was, you know, you're not approaching this from like this sort of anti-civ, like we have to destroy cities and all this stuff. It's more of like, people live in cities, and cities are ecological spaces if we allow it to be. And I want to talk about that, because a lot of these struggles we're talking about are against, you know, extractive industries, mining projects, you know, the building of dams, you know, oil extraction, you know, these things that are deforestation. There's so many different ways in which this is happening in what has been described as like the hinterlands, right? Yeah. But in the core, the capitalist core of cities, urban areas, there are also many different kinds of resistance, forms of resistance that are happening that are ecological. And so I wanted to speak to that, because, again, in this sort of post-capitalist future, where do urban environments fit in this? Where do cities fit in this? Where do people go when cities are no longer the center of capitalist like accumulation, I guess? Yeah. I would really like if you could speak to that, please.
Sure. First, I want to push back on one little thing. I think there is like a lot to offer, or like a lot of interesting things in anti-civilizational anarchy. If what we mean by that is Freddie Perlman and not, you know, some others who I don't need to name.
Sure.
Not a primitivist, but
sure.
there are like some things that frame themselves as critiques of civilization that are worthwhile. So just dropped that there. But I think the divide between the urban rural divide is something that we need to supersede. I think it's an artifact of the capitalist organization of space having sort of different regimes for organizing industry, organizing accumulation and production, sort of different modes that need to coexist, or different strategies that can be applied to one territory or another. And so a lot of city slickers, they think the countryside, and they think it's nature, untouched, nature is every bit as present in the cities as it is in the countryside, not only in a philosophical and true sense that it's every place is an ecosystem, and the idea of nature as something untouched is just ahistorical and ridiculous. Everywhere there's life, everywhere there's relationships between living things, and so that's nature. And also in the more tragic sense of how we're more aware, the extent to which ecosystems have been damaged and asphalted over in the cities. And because most people these days live in urban or suburban environments, and because of nature tourism, they tend to be less aware of the extent to which industrialism has really, really wrecked the countryside and has wrecked rural space. There's also a lot of romanticism around farmers, and there are holdouts who are repositories of beautiful knowledge and beautiful traditions, and actually getting your hands dirty in the soil and respect for all that. But I hate to say it, some people tell me I come off as a judgmental person. I don't know why, but most farmers these days in industrialized countries are horrible in the sense of their relationship with nature, with the environment, kinds of relationships that they cultivate, because they're technicians. Technicians who apply chemicals and who run heavy machinery. Just you would if you're a manager or a technician in a huge factory. They're in a huge factory, but the huge factory is outside of the city and it doesn't have walls, and it's called a farm. And it's no coincidence that a lot of these farmers who are tied to a specific farm. So okay, the bank probably owns it, but they're sort of the live-in managers or whatever, how they systematically treat migrant laborers, mostly racialized migrant laborers, that is no coincidence. And the same sort of hatred and disrespect and exploitation that they have towards racialized migrant laborers, they have that towards the earth, because the only people who could survive in the farming business as agriculture was increasingly industrialized and increasingly subjected to the capitalist need to extract profit, to extract value, were the ones who didn't mind treating the earth like a raw resource. So farms are also a factory. And so we need to break the urban-rural divide, because we need to understand that we are always in nature and we are always a part of nature. And we need to break the urban-rural divide because it is a way that capitalism organizes the exploitation of different territories. I think one really interesting thing, and I was kind of imagining this when I imagined let's say we have a revolution, how are we gonna do that? So the first step was to imagine it where I was living. So Barcelona, Catalonia, more rural Catalonia. Because of course, don't trust anyone who thinks that they have the answer for how everyone on the planet in places that they've never even been to are gonna deal with a revolution, or are gonna deal with the ecological crisis. So Barcelona is a quite dense city. So a lot of people would need to go out in the countryside, but are we imagining lyric Keith authoritarian environmentalism, displacement. Like, we've looked at the statistics and we've decided that 1 million of you must, you know, mm-hmm. go and settle like the High Pyrenees and bring, you know, sustainable agriculture to this, you know, like not dense enough area. Like, that's absurd. And, you know, authoritarian would require a lot of police action, and police require environmental exploitation and, you know, in order to be fed, et cetera, et cetera. You just, you know, stay yeah. within that loop. A lot of folks there still have like some, like, you know, basic memory or contact with like the villages, because like capitalism, I think, has been able to unfold itself in a more violent way in settler states like North America. And one of the results of that is greater alienation. I was talking about this with a close friend really recently about how like that insinuates itself into the culture, so that people even like tend to prefer it, or like think that it's like, you know, kind of like their own choice. People in North America are like really, really ephemeral with place. And I think that's a problem. I don't have like a solution for like, you know, it needs to look like this, but I think like we can be confident in saying that like the relationship between most like non-Indigenous and especially like settler descended North Americans to place is really, really problematic. Mm-hmm. Not just in like, you know, feeling entitled to stolen Indigenous land, but also in the sense of like, you know, just like moving around, like, you know, this city's cool, I'll go check out, you know, this place now, like, to not feeling like invested yeah. in like defending a place or remembering a place. And over there, like, capitalism couldn't like unfold itself on top of like a genocide, like, to the same extent that it could in like North America. So there's like a little bit more memory, and like even white people have like a little bit more in the way of roots. And it's not like, it's not something to romanticize, it's not like mm-hmm. nearly like what it should be, but like a little bit enough so that like a lot of people in the city, like, they have a little bit of connection to someplace in the countryside. Like, maybe their grandparents still live there, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. And it's like an interesting possibility of movement, instead of someone being like entirely urban or entirely rural, and like moving beyond like the transformation of cities. Cause like when you get rid of cars and you get rid of asphalt, like, you can grow a lot of food in cities, but most cities still are not going to be able to be like completely self-sufficient in terms of food. But then on the other hand, like, you know, those of us who have friends who have like these larger scale agricultural projects, or these more ambitious agricultural projects with shepherding, with like, you know, making olive oil, doing grape harvests, like, you know, bigger scale harvests, they need help, and they need a lot of help at specific times of the year. Mm-hmm. So like when we have like connections because like our grandparents still live in that village, or we have connections because, you know, our anarchist friends have like a big old olive orchard, they don't need all of us, you know, hanging around, milling around, like, you know, year round, but like a few times a year, like, they need us to be there. And those of us who, you know, if we're staying in the city, we we need like more food than what we can grow on, like, you know, what used to be the street, mm-hmm. Or on our rooftops. And so like a few times a year, like, we can, like, everyone is like kind of happier that way, because like the people in the countryside have like a lot of help in the times of year when they most need it. The people who are living in a more urban environment and who might culturally really, really like certain things about, like, you know, the density of an urban environment, mm-hmm. a few times a year can, like, you know, get out into the countryside, you know, which, you know, they always love. And like, you know, if sure. Instagram still existed in a post-revolutionary future, which I certainly hope it doesn't, you know, they'd like, you know, fill up their Instagram with all the photos, like, you know, weekend in the countryside with the olive trees, and they come back with like really, really amazing and like healthy olive oil. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. people like no longer have to be one thing, but we can think of certain like migratory patterns that could be really healthy for us. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to do some kind of like Lyra Keith Pol Pot sort of like, let's, you know, depopulate the cities and send everyone to like, you know, work camps in the countryside. And we also don't need to like ignore the fact that like cities as they've been built up under capitalism aren't sustainable and can't really exist right. in the future. Right. So, but like, what if we're like, we're actually all migratory animals like birds. And, you know, some of us are like, you know, more yeah. often in this place, some of us are more often in that place, but none of us are like entirely one thing or the other, but we're like a network that's always in movement. That could work.
Yeah. It sounds more like the relationship between more rural and urban environments would be just substantially different in a post-capitalist yeah. World. Right. I think that's kind of what it gets distilled down to. That is like, yes, these spaces will still exist, and Yeah, if we're not going to entertain these authoritarian ideas of like how to address an ecological, environmental, global crisis, and we were to respect people as what they are and all life, we would probably have to dramatically shift our relation. The relationship between these two spaces would change. They wouldn't be seen as two distinct spaces. They would bleed into each other a lot more. There'd be a lot more overlap of population. I really like that. That helps me conceptualize it better. But I do want to talk about, we have a few minutes before the hour's up, but I don't know how much time you have. You're good. Okay. There are like two major points, but I think we'll just get to something I really wanted to talk about, which is, you know, what I really appreciated is you made a distinction between kind of the hope or an optimism that's not founded in kind of a reality, like a material reality, which I think a lot of people, when I talk to people about the climate crisis, and I know that's reductive, but speaking about that specifically, people are trying to get their head around feedback loops or like, you know, what's happening in the Arctic and the impacts that's having globally and why the weather's getting so fucking weird and why we're having, you know, really severe heat waves and, you know, trying to explain like this is going to get worse and why that is. And people still hold on to this hope and this optimism that something is going to come in. I think this comes from the technocratic gaze in a sense that there are people in charge that are going to figure this out and there's some plan that's going to be implemented, that the emergency is going to get so dire for us that somehow something will come in to fix the problem in some form or another. But that is in contrast to what you present, especially in the last chapter of what I feel is a revolutionary imagination of not looking away from the crisis and what it is, but seeing what it could look like, what it could be instead, and how we can live in a time such as this. And, you know, this thing that I personally, I just wanted to bring this in because something that I present in the podcast often is this idea that regardless of what we do, regardless of revolution, regardless of any of these radical movements coming to a head to upend capitalism, however that is to come about, that there's many things that are happening that are too late, and that, you know, trying to imagine what human life will look like on a planet that is several degrees warmer than it is even now is really hard to contemplate. It's hard to imagine how, even in under the best of circumstances, that human beings could exist in a regenerative relationship with the Earth that is dead. You know, it's kind of this difficult feeling that I try to talk about on this podcast with many people. And I want to talk to you about this. Because in the way you present the last chapter, I had conflicted feelings. One is it was incredibly beautiful and moving, but on one other end of it is like, is this even possible? is it even possible to imagine a future like this? I'm really just trying to, I guess, open the door for you to, or open the space for you to talk about what radical imagination looks like in the context of a planet that is undergoing massive changes as a result of hundreds of years of colonialism and extractive capitalism. Sorry if that's too heavy. I'm sorry. It's just something I have to be honest about and just address. Yeah,
absolutely. We need to be able to sit with the heaviness. I think it is important to distinguish between hope and imagination, as you put it. To address the question of what exactly are we hoping for, and to be able to struggle without hope, depending on like how we're delimiting hope. Sure. The ecological crisis is already here. Tens of millions of people are already dying because of the ecological crisis. And a huge amount of change is already irreversible. That's already happening. There's a high likelihood of, like, you know, crossing the threshold of all these tipping points and getting to, you know, like the so-called hothouse planet scenario. Mm-hmm. which would over like, you know, the next, I mean, you know, pretty dramatically just in the next 100 years, but like in a major way in the next 5 to 20,000 years, like leads to like the change or total replacement of like every single ecosystem on the planet. Mm-hmm. There will still be life. It will still be a living planet until the sun expands and swallows up the earth in like, you know, several billion years. And so for me, like people who are struggling to try to stop the climate crisis from happening or trying to like preserve things as they exist now, like that's, this is harsh, but that's naive. That's not real. Mm-hmm. And so we need to struggle accepting that a huge amount of change and a huge amount of suffering is already underway and unavoidable. And we really don't know to what extent that will play out, when or how it will settle into a new dynamic equilibrium. All we know is that we are outside of the dynamic equilibrium that has existed for the Holocene. Mm-hmm. And there are big changes and a lot of suffering already underway. If, you know, we were going to gamble, then we would be smarter to bet against us. Whether the us is probably not the human species. The human species probably won't go extinct in the next 1,000 years, but like certainly bet against us, like, you know, anarchists and like, you know, radical indigenous movements, like fighting to get their land back, and anti-capitalists, like certainly bet against that smaller us. And like, you know, possibly also bet against like a larger us of like, you know, life that looks like anything similar to what it looks now. But like gambling on a sinking ship is like a pretty stupid thing to do. So like, why do that? Why not struggle and why not do everything we can to like affect the outcome in the best possible way? If there is some kind of societal collapse, we, you know, want to like our struggles now will change whether the survivors have made like, you know, a cult of like the lost stability and the lost glory and the lost wealth, or if the survivors know who's to blame for what happened. And they know that like, you know, whatever new society that they need to make from the ashes should be as much as possible the exact opposite of what caused this crisis. I talk about this a little bit in Worshiping Power, a book that I wrote about state formation, presenting a hypothesis of like the late Bronze Age collapse, which was the collapse of like a lot of states in the Eastern Mediterranean a few thousand years ago. Like most states that existed at that time collapsed, and they probably collapsed in part due to like rebellion and revolution. It was also like a social collapse, and the survivors quite possibly didn't go far enough in like their radical memory and their radical imagination in terms of identifying like what was it that they were revolting against, what was like the seed of like that oppression that they were revolting against. And because of that, like several generations later, they resurrected the state, a very, very different kind of state, but they resurrected the democratic state based on enslavement, on like slave raiding, based on commerce, et cetera, like the Greek city states. So we would want to make sure if in that like really, really bad scenario of societal collapse, that we struggle as hard as we can so that people remember what capitalism and white supremacy and colonialism and patriarchy were, and they remember it as like the absolute enemy, to like always like, you know, make sure that it doesn't crop up again amongst us in less dramatic scenarios without societal collapse. You know, well, we'd really like to have a world without capitalism that's not just like having like the sort of techno management of like, you know, an unfolding ecological crisis. So there are so many reasons to keep on struggling even without like the naive hope of like avoiding something that's already unfolding. And there's so many reasons to struggle those days that we're really, really depressed because we wake up, we open the window and we smell burning forests, or, you know, are like, you know, we like read the news about like, you know, hundreds of millions of people in Pakistan having their houses washed away in flooding.
Yeah.
Or we're just like really, really depressed because capitalism is miserable and patriarchy is miserable and white supremacy is miserable. And they just create a lot of misery and we don't really maybe even want to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's still reasons to struggle. So I really think hope shouldn't be tied to struggle, but I think imagination is always a really powerful tool and a really powerful weapon for the most intelligent and ironically, the most hopeful, the most optimistic, the most far-reaching, and the most caring sorts of struggles. So yeah, so I think that's an important distinction to make.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, it's like, I don't know. No one knows what the future holds exactly, right? We can make projections. We can have an idea of like where the trends are leading. But like, I would say like, if I were to take my most dire ideas about this and say human beings will go extinct in like 10 years, let's just throw that out there. I don't know if it will happen. Of course, I can't know that. I cannot know that, but let's say that's true. Like, how do you want to spend those 10 years? Do you want it to be in service to a system that's creating that extinction crisis, the crisis of extinction, that is tied to that system specifically? Do you want to serve that or do you want to resist that? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think with all of these things that you presented in the book, people are like, no, we refuse to go out like this if this is in fact the end. None of them are saying that. That's nothing. None of that's being said in the book. But I think the sense of like the collective moment we're all sharing is felt among all these people in various territories and localities around the world. And also, I just want to acknowledge that I'm speaking as a white person in the global north. So for me, the apocalypse feels new, and for people that are indigenous and people that have lived in their, you know, the places that they have lived for a very long time and have a cultural memory of what their ancestors and what they currently are experiencing, the apocalypse has been here for over 500 years. So I want to make sure I frame the dread that I'm feeling within that context of my own lived experiences and where I come from.
Yeah, that's really important.
Yeah. So all that to say, like, we were talking a little over an hour. There's plenty more I could bring up because I really enjoyed your book a great deal. And there's a lot of, like, it's interesting. You get through, you're like, I think this chapter is going to be about this, but there's like little nuggets in there that you put in, that weave in there. And I'm like, oh, that would be a great conversation piece. And so there's a lot more to discuss, but I really want to just point people toward your book because it's a significant work. And so I thank you for writing it. For the amount of, I can tell the amount of love and attention that you put into it. So I want to thank you for it. And I really want to thank you for the time to come on here and speak with me again.
Thanks so much for your feedback. It's really, really sweet of you. And thanks for the invitation, for sure.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.